Joseph.
May it please the court, Larry Joseph for the American Road and Transportation Builders Association. With me is Nick Goldstein, the Associate General Counsel of ARTBA. This case concerns preemption under the Federal Clean Air Act of vehicles and engines used to propel movable equipment. It comes from essentially three strands of litigation that all start with the letters EMA. There's the EMA versus South Coast, which went up to the Supreme Court, back down to the Ninth Circuit, and then back down to the District Court. There's the EMA case from this court from 1996, EMA versus EPA, and also EMA versus Houston, which was litigation in Texas over actions taken by the state of Texas. There are four issues that we've presented. There's whether fleets are standards that apply to fleets as opposed to a particular vehicle are covered by the preemption. There's the extent, the applicability and extent of the market participant exclusion to preemption. There is the issue of Section 209E1, its treatment of locomotives on the one hand versus small construction and farm equipment on the other, whether that equivalent treatment in the statute allows disparate treatment in implementation. And then finally, there's an in-use issue that that this court has previously addressed in EMA versus EPA. We think that's not covered by direct precedent of this court because there are issues we raise that weren't raised there. We weren't a litigant there. We didn't have a ripe challenge there. Anyway, the way that ARTBA came to this set of issues was Texas adopted some regulations that basically required the accelerated turnover of vehicles. So vehicles that were new when you bought them, still within their federally regulated useful life, and all of a sudden Texas was requiring you to sell them and buy new equipment so that you would have a cleaner fleet, less emissions. And they also are requiring construction companies not to operate between the hours of 6 in the morning and noon. And the theory there was that if the emissions, you just shifted the workday late enough and the emissions went up into the air when the sun wasn't out, that would somehow shift the ozone-causing chemistry between the different gases that go up in the air. So ARTBA petitioned EPA. ARTBA succeeded in that litigation. EMA was a co-party. I don't believe they had standing here, but we did. We succeeded in that. At the district court level, Texas vacated the rule, and so to prevent that from happening again, we petitioned the agency back in 2002 on those two issues, the fleet issue and the in-use issue. We were able to convince the district judge, at least, that this court's ruling in EMA versus EPA was an error. Then the EMA versus EPA case, EMA versus South Coast case ended up addressing the fleet section and the market participant exception. And finally, these issues aren't as discrete as I've sort of made them out. So, for instance, in the Texas litigation, the thing that was pretty obviously a fleet requirement and therefore a standard, they said it wasn't a standard, it was an in-use requirement. You can't use this equipment if it doesn't meet the standard. So there's a sense in which they all sort of blend together, because also the 209E1 says states cannot regulate new construction equipment less than 175 horsepower. So the question is, well, what is
it? Your Texas example suggests that where, maybe I've got this wrong, maybe it's not the case. At least there's relief in certain circumstances in the district court. And it is relief that can bring into play the validity not only of what the state has done, but the validity of what EPA has done.
Yes, we succeeded in convincing the district judge not to follow EPA, not to follow this court's precedent. That doesn't preclude review if that's the implied
question. No. It doesn't ipso facto preclude review, but it does indicate that it doesn't present us with a case, as perhaps the last one did, of a in principle illegal act going without judicial review.
Well, you know, the Clean Air Act provides judicial review in instances like this. There's no adequate remedy.
Well, but that, you see, that's where we get to the 60-day limitation, right?
Well, that doesn't begin to apply if we didn't have a right challenge in 1994, which we did not. No one was threatening to do this.
Yes, but to the extent that you're attacking the rule, the 60-day limitation does apply, right?
And we are challenging the rule. We're challenging two final agents. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's what I'm saying. That it does, the 60-day limitation does.
We filed within 60 days of the final rulemaking. We filed within.
You're not attacking the original rule. You're attacking the refusal to repeal the rule, right? Is that right?
And also the denial of the petition. Yes.
Yes.
But also the repromulgation of the rule.
Yes, I got that part too. The repromulgation, but not the original rule.
No, I suppose not. I mean, there's no. I don't know what there's
well,
nothing.
Suppose not. It's more than 60 days since that rule.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know that we would have a justiciable case against that.
But then you encounter what I can only call a mixed set of decisions by this court on the effect of such 60-day limitations. Right.
Yes.
And the extent to which a petition for a new rulemaking can, I don't want to use the term end run because that seems to prejudge the matter, but at least qualifies the impact of the 60-day bar, and that there is at least dictum and possibly something stronger in National Mining Association, I think it is. We have M as always, but slightly different initials on either side of it. Which seems to say that under language such as is involved in the statute here, the 60-day burden is absolute, so that the standard ability to petition for a new rulemaking ceases to have the effects that it had in a large bunch of other cases of this circuit.
In the Clean Air Act specific context, I don't know how to pronounce the tribe's name, but I'll call it Navajo Tribe versus Train from 1975. The court there said you have to go back and present these issues to EPA before you can petition, and we're not going to be strict about this thing. And Congress affirmatively adopted, both the House and the Senate reports affirmatively adopted that in the 1977 amendments. So whatever is true of the Surface Mining, et cetera, Act, that's not true of the Clean Air Act. Congress would be surprised, based on what they said, for you to hold that. And the issue here, essentially, whether it was by design or laziness, EPA addressed the 209E problem.
Sorry, do you cite this Navajo Tribe case?
I will, if it's all right. I mean, absolutely. But could we continue, and I'll give that to you in reply?
Oh, so it is in the briefs.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. What EPA did with the 209E problem is they looked at everyone but locomotives. They held locomotives aside. They adopted a very stringent or miserly interpretation of preemption. They succeeded in this court. And then they came back and offered a very generous preemption provision for trains. And when EMA was in this court, I'm not sure they had standing for the in-use issues. Maybe they have forklifts. They certainly don't have construction equipment under in-use construction equipment under 275 or 175 horsepower. But they didn't talk about trains, locomotives, and locomotives are critical because if you look at this from a presumption against preemption, circa 1994-96, in that time frame. The theory would be, how would Congress come in and take away our power to regulate these non-road construction equipment without saying so? And I think they do say so, and we'll get to that. But with locomotives, it's how would Congress come in and take away a century of preemption that applied to in-use locomotives without saying so? So EPA sort of hid the ball and then succeeded in a narrow solution.
Couldn't it have been challenged after the locomotive rule went into effect?
Well, that's essentially what this is, really, because you couldn't just challenge the locomotive rule. What's that? No, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, in 98. Yeah. you would have had to, the comments were already in on all that stuff.
Yeah.
So you would have had, you have to do what we did. You have to present, and this is the Navajo tribe case, so I'll bring the citation with me when I return. You have to present the issue to the agency first, and we did that, and then their final answer is reviewable. It's O-L-I-J-A-T-O, I believe, is the first name in the case if you're looking it up. So that's the issue with the locomotives, is they succeeded by sidestepping the truly applicable presumption, which is that Congress wouldn't pull away that preemption with, sub silentio. There's also some changes since 1996 that are very relevant and I think controlling, and that there's the Geyer versus American Honda case, which basically says that you can have conflict preemption, notwithstanding that there's express preemption and a savings clause. In MEMA versus EPA, this court basically said that there's a presumption against preemption in this 209E context based on the fact that there was no conflict preemption in just such a circumstance. Geyer essentially overrules that aspect of MEMA. By the way, in the Supreme Court,
Geyer overrules which case?
MEMA versus EPA. It's a, I think, 1979 decision of this case. It overrules the notion that there is a presumption against preemption in the 209E context, which MEMA held, but Geyer nullifies. And the presumption,
that's a pretty strong reading of Geyer.
Okay.
I mean, possible, but it's certainly not.
Well, it says that conflict preemption is available.
To the extent you can get any clear rules out of the preemption area, that's good for you. But.
Okay. So where that's important is in Section 246, which applies to motor vehicle fleets, not non-road fleets. The two are distinct categories. But it goes to the question of what the word standard means. And this is an issue that actually confused both the eight judges and the justices in the majority and Justice Souter in dissent in EMA versus South Coast. They were looking for the notwithstanding clause. Like 246 basically provides for the ability for certain dirty air areas, serious or worse ozone non-attainment areas, to regulate fleets of 10 vehicles or more. And it doesn't. It puts that burden on them to do these fleet rules. They can opt out by providing a rule with a similar emission reduction. But it's not just a requirement. There's an upside for the fleets. They're given credits in certain circumstances. They're given access to HOV lanes, etc. So it's a mixed bag. The fleets get something, and they obviously have to buy clean vehicles. Where that's relevant here, notwithstanding that non-road vehicles are not subject to it, is it goes to the meaning of the word standard and the extent to which the preemptive standards apply, not just the day they roll off the showroom floor, but throughout their useful life. The reason, you have to think of it this way. Either 246, which is in Title II, Subpart C, either that preempted something that otherwise was allowed, because if you buy that, there's conflict preemption, because it's a ceiling and a floor, so a state can't, and both the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit on remand recognize that 246 can provide conflict preemption. So if you accept that conflict preemption can apply if a state, for example, hits fleets with obligations but doesn't give them the benefits, then it's preempting something that otherwise was allowed. Alternatively, you could say that it's allowing something that was otherwise preempted, which is our view, and that is that it's over here in Title 2C, it's providing a course that you can provide, you, a state, can provide regulations that meet all of its criteria, and then you're meeting Title 2C. Title 2A, which is where 209B and C live, I'm sorry, A and B live, that the preemption is only for this part, which is Title 2A, which doesn't include Title 2C. And if you're operating under Title 2C, you're not violating the preemption of Title 2A, which is 209B. And so you're actually doing something that it's allowing you to do something that was otherwise preempted. And the significance of that is that it applies to fleets, not just the day they're purchased, but their useful life. And this all goes to an element both for on-road and off-road of 209, which is it has to be consistent with this section for 209E and consistent with 202A for the on-road fleets. And what that includes among lead time and technological feasibility is it's also that includes a useful life component, and this court's decision in AMC versus Bloom applied a similar provision from within 202A linking to 202B, it was in that case. Here the useful life is directly in 202A, but in AMC versus Bloom, they linked from 202A to 202B, and then they said because the administrator, the EPA, was not giving the relief afforded by this 202A, it was inconsistent with 202A, and therefore a preemption waiver couldn't be granted. Finally, the EMA versus South Coast remand decision, the Ninth Circuit panel.
Back up for this for 1 second. All of what you just said went to our EMA decision, is that right or not?
Yes. And also the EMA versus South Coast. It explained something the EMA versus South Coast found missing, which is a notwithstanding clause, but it also explained why it's sort of a third course, so to speak, between new means showroom new, and new means post-enactment new. It's that new preemption for newness lasts during the federally regulated useful life. That's been our position all along, and therefore it's really both.
Does this require us to change the decision in our EMA case? What you're saying now?
Not really. No. I mean, it's an extent. It requires EPA's wrong. I mean, maybe new does mean showroom new, but that's almost irrelevant. It certainly doesn't mean post-enactment new. There's one more point I'd like to make, and I have 3 minutes still. The EMA versus South Coast remand decision, where they say the market participant exception doesn't apply, or that enforcement doesn't matter. The fact that it's criminally or civilly can be penalized civilly or criminally doesn't matter. That's dicta because.
I just ask who is being criminally penalized in that situation. I was very unclear about this. So this is when the state buys a fleet itself, right?
The decision by the Ninth Circuit is a Salerno narrow decision, and they're saying.
I just want the facts before we get to the law. This is when the state or a state entity buys a fleet? Is that what we're talking about? States purchase for...
The fleet rules apply to private parties.
I'm not talking about the private party part. I'm talking about the market participant part.
Where they right. Buy what the Ninth Circuit held was that because the state could have these fleets...
For itself. Yes.
The market participant exemption applied, and the fact that it was criminally...
Who would a criminal penalty apply to?
It doesn't apply to the government. So the Ninth Circuit was the Ninth Circuit.
It doesn't apply to anyone in the market participant theory, does it?
That's our argument.
I guess I'm not making this.
In other words, okay.
With respect to they can't. It's clear that they can't have fleet rule. At least EPA seems to agree there can't be a fleet rule for private entities. Correct.
Right. The issue is when it's contract. If the government's buying fleets, I actually do think that's preempted. For example, a police department could sue.
Hold with me for 1 second. I've got to be a little slower. You've spent a lot of time on this case. I spent a lot of time on this case, but not as much as you. So just give me a break for just 1 second. Leaving aside the rules about private fleets, okay, which I understand the government agrees with you, I want to ask about public fleets. That is, for example, a local police department, right? Why does it matter whether there's criminal penalties or not? I assume that the police chief is not going to go to jail if the police chief buys the wrong kind of car. Is that wrong or right? What's the relevance of the criminal penalties under those circumstances?
Well, it comes into play when there's a contract, sort of dividing something between your two fleets.
Yeah.
If you're a private contractor building roads for a public government and there's a contract and it requires clean fuel vehicles, that's where this becomes problematic. In California, none of the penalties even apply to the government. It only applies to us if
so
we...
So the circumstance you're talking about is the government says, we won't, if you're going to build this road for us, you have to use a clean fleet, and then they don't use a clean fleet, and then they're subject to criminal penalties?
Well, it breaks down. If they want to keep building the road because they have a deadline and the...
Without government permission?
Right, yeah.
Without the government? So,
well, let me, even with knowledge, then you could be sued in a citizen suit by a NIMBY.
Not criminally, you can't be sued.
Well, but the same principle applies to punitive civil fines and So we don't need to focus on criminal. It's punitive civil fines are equally applicable, and the environmental statutes are punitive civil fines per the U.S. Supreme Court. So either way, it's not a liquidated damages clause, and it's outside the contractor and into the sovereign regulator.
Well, you can have civil punitive damages clauses under contract, right?
None of the liquidated damages clause.
What?
A liquidated damages clause is, you know, if I don't deliver the citation.
It's above liquidated damages.
It's beyond that, right? It's punitive, and if it's punitive, it can't be. And then finally, the language from Allway Taxi versus City of New York, that case involved some pre-regulation vehicles and the authority to regulate EPA-regulated vehicles, but there was nothing in that second category. So the case was really only about the ability of New York to impose requirements on unregulated vehicles, which we concede is not covered. But the question is whether they can regulate vehicles that are EPA-regulated, and there were no animals of that stripe in that case, and so whatever the court had to say about that was dicta, and EPA's reliance on it was misplaced for that reason.
Further questions? Thank you. Mr. Gunter.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David Gunter. I'm here this morning to represent the United States and to defend EPA's decision not to grant ARTBA's petition to amend EPA's rules. With me at council table is Michael Horowitz of EPA's Office of General Counsel. Also representing the interveners in support of EPA in this case are Kate Keneally from the State of California Attorney General's Office and Barbara Baird from the South Coast Air Quality Management District. There are two broad points that I'd like to cover in my argument this morning. First, the jurisdictional reasons why the court should not reach ARPA's petition, and second, the merits reasons why, if the court does reach that petition, it must be denied. To summarize those quickly, on the question of jurisdiction, ARTBA here, and before EPA, is actually challenging decisions that EPA first made in 1994 and that have been part of EPA's regulations since that time in substantially the same form. ARTBA has missed the 60-day window that the Clean Air Act provides to challenge those regulations, and ARTBA also does not have standing to challenge the regulations because it has not yet been harmed by EPA's generalized interpretation of Section 209E. If the court...
The standard for harm includes imminent harm. So their contention is that the existing rule allows states to burden them in ways that the rule should not. So what's the standing problem?
The standing problem arises from the case of Louisiana Environmental Action Network versus Browner, in which the court considered state implementation plan approval criteria that EPA had promulgated. But the court said that until a state implementation plan was actually promulgated, the petitioner wasn't harmed. Now, here you've identified the additional problem that ARPA raises, which is that there are state regulations at issue.
Yeah.
However, standing also requires redressability. Those state regulations can't now be invalidated by this court.
Why not? I mean, why wouldn't an invalidation of the currently existing regulation in due course entail invalidation of state regulations which depend on them?
In due course it would, but the harm is not imminent because there is always another EPA decision that will take place before the state regulations apply to ARTBA. For example, here ARTBA is complaining about California's ORD and soon rules.
That would be true at the very outset of the promulgation of these rules. You're basically saying that there's no, I mean, this Abbott Labs is out the window. there's no standing to challenge a rule.
Enforcement.
Because a party will have a chance later at enforcement?
It's not even at the enforcement stage. Here there's a chance to challenge a later decision, namely EPA's authorization decision under Section 209E2, before these rules get... So the first step is that EPA will identify its interpretation of the scope of preemption under Section 209E, but then states will pass regulations, will promulgate regulations, which then have to be approved by EPA under Section 209E2 before they can go into effect.
My recollection is your brief points to extant state regulations, right? So they've apparently already been approved. The petitioners want to have those approvals, essentially, de facto, rendered illegal, which sounds distinctly beneficial to them.
There are some regulations for which that's not the case, for which EPA has...
Let's talk about the ones that, for which...
So, for instance, the Texas regulations, which have been in effect since 2001, and which EPA has already approved as part of a SIP, as I just mentioned, EPA already approved them as part of a state implementation plan, and so a proper time to challenge those regulations would have been when they were first promulgated. A change in EPA's interpretation of Section 209E now is not going to go back and require the invalidation.
Keep going. Sorry.
What's your authority for that? I noticed that in your brief, and I was really struck by it. In other words, it turns out that when the statute is correctly read, that an EPA approval is unlawful, and that's the end of the matter. It remains on the books. It's happily enforced. Even though it's unlawful?
No, it may be then that Texas would be required to revise its implementation.
Well, okay. So that presumably would be the second step in the relief that the petitioner seeks.
Even if that were the case, though, ARPA would have missed the 60-day window.
Well, that's a different matter.
Well, that was my question. If they had brought this challenge within the 60-day window, would they have had standing?
It appears under the court's rulings in Lean and Grassroots that they would not have had standing. That in the event they had challenged within the first 60 days, there would have been no state regulation at issue, and therefore they would not have been harmed by it at that time, or at least there would be no imminent harm. As the court showed in Lean, however, it can identify if there is a challenge within the original 60-day window. The court can identify if at some later time a challenge may become appropriate. Now, the court in Lean made that ruling with respect to ripeness, rather than withstanding. But the issue you've identified, that there may not have been standing in 1994, is compelled by this court's rules, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there is never an opportunity.
I was just teasing out whether your standing argument is distinct from your 60-day, and it is, which is the right answer, I think, for your position.
It is distinct, yes. Actually, this might be an appropriate time to turn to the 60-day argument. I'd like to address the idea that ARPA has raised that it can reopen a 60-day window by asking the agency to amend its regulations and then appealing from, or rather seeking review of, the denial of EPA's decision. As Judge Williams pointed out, the court in National Mining Association seemed to suggest that is not appropriate, and although he was reluctant to use the term end run around the 60-day requirement of the Clean Air Act, I'm not reluctant to do that.
Let me just call your attention to page 1350 of that decision. The court notes that challenges may be brought as petitions for a new rule and thereafter as petitions for review of an agency denial, which is what ARPA has tried here. Then it says, but in those cases, Congress did not specifically address the consequences of failure to bring a challenge within the statutory period. So now I ask you, assuming that's all I've done is read the actual words of the decision, where is the language in the statute here which specifically addresses the consequences of failure to meet the 60-day limit?
That language is in Section 307B of the Clean Air Act, which provides that challenges to regulations need to be brought within 60 days.
Yes.
And it goes on to specify the only circumstances in which a challenge may be brought.
That doesn't state the consequence of not meeting it. It has a double set of deadlines, obviously, but it doesn't say the consequences of not meeting either deadline.
Well, this court has held...
It's more refined, as it were, than the standard Hobbs Act language, but in the sense that it deals with the further hypothetical, but it's hard for me to see that it explicitly says what happens if you don't meet the deadline.
The language may be different from the Hobbs Act, but the effect is the same. This court has held, and Edison Electric Institute is the site
same,
that comes
the same under the Hobbs Act is that the person who has missed the 60-day deadline can petition for a new rule and get review of the denial of that petition.
I'm sorry, under the Hobbs Act that's
yes.
available? Under National
yeah.
Mining Association?
Well, the National Mining Association distinguishes the Hobbs Act. It says the statute there provided the consequence of not meeting the deadline. And it accepts, as of course it must, as Judge Garland pointed out a few minutes ago, our pre-existing authority, Edison Electric, Public Citizen, Functional Music, NLRB Union, there are others.
Right. The difference there is that in this case, well, Congress did not specifically say that if you miss the 60-day window, you may never sue. But I think that is the effect of the court's holdings that the 60-day window is a jurisdictional requirement in the Clean Air Act. I don't know what it might mean that the 60-day window is a jurisdictional requirement other than after that time, the petitioner's petition may not be heard.
Petitioner's petition challenging the rule directly may not be heard, but historically, the remedy of petitioning for a new rulemaking and contesting the denial of that petition has been available, subject to a very lax standard of review. That lax in the sense that the agency gets a very, very high degree of deference. That's what these cases, Edison Electric, Public Citizen, NLRB Union, and Functional Music essentially stand for.
There are cases that go that direction, but there are other cases that go in the opposite direction.
Well,
for example,
well,
ICC versus Brotherhood of Locomotive
that's
Engineers.
Judge Williams described this as mixed.
and I would agree that the cases are mixed, but I think that
doesn't address the context of a petition for a new rulemaking.
Right? ICC versus Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, you mean. Not a new rulemaking, but it addresses the context of reopening an agency's prior order. That is carried through in National Association of Reversionary Property Owners to address the situation of a specific rule. I think that the court is correct to identify these cases as mixed, but the point that seems to distinguish them is whether or not the requirement, the timeliness requirement in the statute is jurisdictional.
You're not taking the position, are you, that under NMA, if the government does, if the agency does reopen, that there can't be a review of the decision after reopening to keep the same rule, are you?
That's right. That's not my position.
Right, because in NMA, the court expressly said that, evaluated it and decided that there was no reopening in that case. It didn't say that because of the 60-day rule, there would be no review for once there's been reopening, right?
That's right. If this rule had been reopened, then the reopener of the rule will be a new final agency action that could be challenged.
Right. So let me ask you about that then.
Okay.
So the court, in deciding that in NMA that it wasn't reopened, the court said that the 1983 – I'm having a little trouble reading my Westlaw here – but that the 1983 action was sufficient to reopen it. At that time, the department explicitly requested comment on the repeal of the NOV rule, which they did in this case, correct?
I actually don't believe that they did.
You don't think there was a request for comments?
There was a request for comment on whether a new rulemaking should be instituted, whether EPA should grant or deny ARPA's petition to begin a new rulemaking process. And so parties commented on that. That necessarily requires at least some inquiry into the underlying substantive issues. Has there been enough change in the underlying substantive issues to require the institution of a new rulemaking? But cases make clear, for example, ICC versus Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, that merely responding to a petition for rulemaking.
Yes, but that's fine, but that wasn't a rulemaking in that case anyway. But that's not what happened here. They had comments on the validity of the rule. They responded in pretty much detail to it, and then they repromulgated the rule, right? It wasn't just that we deny your petition. They actually repromulgated the rule.
They repromulgated one of the rules. Mm-hmm. Appendix A kept the same section number and exactly the same language. Mm-hmm. 85.1603 was assigned two different section numbers and was changed to be put into plain language. And I believe the only change that took place in the language of that regulation was changing states and political subdivisions thereof to states and localities. Now,
that would be the definition of repromulgate. That is, they don't change it, they keep the old rule, but they restate it.
Yes. But in the unrelated rulemaking on small spark ignition engines in which EPA sought comment on ARPA's petition for rulemaking, EPA said that it is not reconsidering the underlying substantive issues that ARPA has raised. Instead, it was seeking comment on whether it should grant or deny ARPA's petition and begin a new rulemaking. Again, in the final rule, when EPA denied ARPA's petition for rulemaking, EPA said, we are not proposing any substantive changes to the regulations that ARPA has raised here, but we would like, but after viewing the comments on whether we should institute a new rulemaking, we have decided that we should not. That does not constitute reopening the underlying rule. In addition, if the court looks at American Iron and Steel Institute, there are several factors that go into the repromulgation of a rule, even if the text of that rule doesn't change. Those factors include setting out the language of the rule as a new regulation. Arguably, that occurred here because EPA put it into plain language form. It also, however, includes explaining the agency's rationale for the original rule, seeking comment on that rationale, and responding to the comments. The agency didn't do any of those things here, except to mention the underlying substantive issues when it responded to ARPA's petition for rulemaking. EPA responded to that petition and gave its opinion about those issues to the extent necessary to explain why it was not opening a new rulemaking. But there must be space for the agency to respond to a petition for rulemaking, even making reference to the underlying substantive issues and explaining why they don't need to be reopened, without actually reopening the rule. And there are cases that demonstrate that a denial of a petition for rulemaking may not be a reopener, even if the agency discusses at least some underlying substantive issues.
Can I ask you one question that's a little out of order here, and okay. I apologize for that. But going back to Judge Williams' question, I thought your answer on national mining was going to be that the language of the Act here is similar to the language of the Act at issue in National Mining Association. In other words, it specified the consequences. Well, whether it did or not, the language there was deemed to, and therefore the language here should be deemed to.
That is the case. I don't recall the precise language of the Hobbs Act issue that Judge Williams raised earlier, but I think that...
the Act at issue in National Mining said, or after such date if the petition is based solely on grounds arising after the 60th day. So, and we have similar language here. It's phrased a little differently, but except that if such petition is based solely on grounds arising after such 60th day... And the point was that by specifying that was the only ground you could come in after the 60th day, that was specifying the consequences of the failure to do so.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay.
ARPA claims, to stay with that point for just a minute, on a related point, ARPA claims that it did not have a ripe claim in 1994 and therefore that it does have a ripe claim now. In the Louisiana Environmental Action Network case, the court tied that specific language to the ripeness question that ARPA has raised, and said that the new evidence or changed circumstances language or grounds arising after the 60th day language is the hook on which the court can allow the opening of a new 60-day window at the time the claim ripens. But the fact that ARPA may not have had a ripe claim then doesn't excuse it from failing to file a petition within the original 60-day window. The court held in Eagle Pitcher Industries v. EPA, I'm sorry, I don't have the citation in front of me now.
I might be missing this. Are you saying if you file then, it would be thrown out because it's not ripe, and if you filed now, it's too late?
If you file then, the court might decide on a prudential basis that it's not ripe, but that is the court's decision to make.
Well, wait, this is not prudential. You said there was no standing at that point. Didn't you say earlier when we were discussing this that there was no standing? That's not a ripeness question. There's no standing.
I do think that result is compelled by Lien and by Grassroots, cases.
So if within the first 60 days there's no standing, we have to throw it out. And if you get standing afterwards, we have to throw it out because you didn't sue within the period in which you had no standing?
I think that is the logical result.
Of what?
Of
illogical.
of the cases in Lien and Grassroots. But,
which means it's agency action is unreviewable even if it directly affects a regulated party.
That's not the case because, as I mentioned before, with the way that Section 209E preemption is set up, there is a stage after EPA promulgates its initial interpretation of the scope of preemption at which EPA must then pass on the validity of a state regulation, and that is the authorization procedure in Section 209E2. That is a reviewable procedure.
This seems a very indirect way for Congress to essentially eliminate from this range of decisions the application of Abbott Labs.
By that you mean the criteria for ripeness that the court identified in Abbott Labs?
Yes. Ripeness encompassing standing, too.
Well, I think that in, for example, the Abbott Labs criteria include fitness of the issues for judicial review.
You don't have a serious question on that, do you? Or do you?
With respect to EPA's generalized interpretation of Section 209, I think so, because EPA would contend that it is necessary to have a specific state regulation at issue before you can determine whether the Clean Air Act preempts it. I mean, this is the problem with the market participant exception. EPA has essentially declined to take a position on that exception, saying that the courts in the first instance should be the arbiter of whether the market participant exception applies. And we've seen a long chain of litigation, which Mr. Joseph described to you, in which courts have been able to identify the record on which a state rule is based, look at the effects of that rule on the regulated party, determine whether they are harmed, and determine whether that harm is consistent or inconsistent with the Clean Air Act. And that does provide a venue in which these issues can be adjudicated.
So you're saying this rule could never be challenged on its face in a pre-enforcement, pre-authorization action? Which you don't need for your position here, I might add. But anyway, you're saying that.
That's right. I don't need for my position here.
This is the generic provision under the Clean Air Act for review of EPA rules, right?
It is.
So this is a strong position you're taking.
It is a position that's based on the court's holding in Lien, that at the time the EPA promulgates criteria for future approval of a state rule, that there is no standing at that time.
I don't have it in front of me, but I think you're over-reading Lien.
That clearly is for the court to decide. I haven't had much opportunity to discuss the merits yet, and I see that I'm over my time, but I would like to make one point, unless the court would like to hear more, about the use restrictions issue. Mr. Joseph discussed why he believes ARPA's interpretation of Section 209E and the relationship between Section 209 and 213 and 246 is a better reading than the one that EPA offered and that the court approved in EMA. But to accept that argument would turn Chevron on its head. The court did determine that the question of whether Section 209 preempts use restrictions was ambiguous. And the court determined that in the EMA case in 1996, which, by the way, is the challenge that was brought during the original 60-day window when these regulations were first promulgated.
Your argument on this was just that EMA controls end of matter for this panel.
That is my argument, yes.
That's easier.
Indeed. Unless the court has further questions, we'll rest on our briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Gunner.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Ms. Keneally.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Kathleen Keneally. I'm with the California Attorney General's Office, and I'm here representing the California Air Resources Board. We very much appreciate the court's indulgence in giving us 5 minutes to address you. There's only a couple of things that I'd like to raise with the court, and I think it's probably adding on to the discussion earlier about the state rules that ARPA talks about, our off-road in-use diesel rule and the South Coast Soon rule, whether or not those are before the court. And our view, as stated in our briefs, is that those are not before the court today. Now, Judge Williams raised the point of earlier whether or not if the court rejects EPA's interpretation of 209E, could that somehow, you know, wouldn't that affect these rules?
Can I just pause for one second? I sort of thought your opponent gave up on this. Maybe I'm overreading their brief, but I understood them to say they are not trying to vacate your rules in this proceeding. Did you read it? Did you read it the same way?
Your Honor, if that's their position, we certainly agree with it.
Yeah.
And we can just stop. Yeah. No more to be said on that, if that's their position. I mean, we just wanted to be available to the court if the court was interested in those issues. We think the rules themselves are not before the court. We certainly accept the principle that if the court were to construe the act in a way that affected those rules, it certainly couldn't be ignored. But they're pending the EPA waiver process now, and they'll go through the 209E process, and the court and EPA at that time will look at what 209E means, certainly probably in light of what happens here today. So that's the
and
first.
And the rules, I take it, could be challenged at that point.
Yes, they could. And not only that, the rules, 209E is a very kind of particularized process the Congress set up. The rules could be challenged under state law independently, and some of our rules have even been challenged independently in a federal district court in California under varying theories. So our rules are subject to wide-ranging and very much judicial review. So the 209E process, or the 209 process, depending on if it's a motor vehicle regulation, is a very specific, particularized path that Congress created where EPA opens or closes the preemption gate on the rule if it's an emission standard. So that's a separate proceeding, and that's the point we want to make about those initial rules. And then the other thing we wanted to come up today to, for the court is to talk about the market participant doctrine and just simply to be available to the court if the court
Okay, you heard my question I asked before. Could you help me understanding with respect to how the criminal enforcement goes with respect to a government fleet or market participant?
Your Honor, I think I can. And I can offer a couple of comments and observations on that. The first thing is that, number one, there have never, ever been any criminal referrals made under any fleet rules ever. I'm informed by the South Coast Council today. And the other thing is, we cite in our brief at page 17, EMA versus the South Coast, 498 F3rd at 1048. In that case, the court said, we do not believe that the enforcement provisions have the effect of transforming a rule from a proprietary to a regulatory action. Basically, you know, the court was saying, look, those provisions are just not relevant. What's relevant is you look at the rule and you look at whether or not it's the state is acting as a market participant. If it is, the rule is accepted, and if it's not, then it's not accepted. So the court simply said those were not relevant. And I think I share your concern. I can't see how it would make a difference whether what the penalty was when you're trying to make an application of whether the state itself is acting as a market participant or not.
Mr. Gunter said the EPA wasn't even taking a position on this. Right.
I think that's right. I think that's the correct view because it's a judicially created doctrine, and it's going to be applied on its fact in the future as on its facts in the future as cases develop. And it doesn't seem to make sense for EPA to take a position here, you know, in the context of offering its interpretation of 209E. So we agree with that. And if there are no other questions, I have nothing
further.
The
first person to sit down with 14 seconds left. We'll mark you in the record books for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. Now, Mr. Joseph. I think, have I left anybody out here? No.
In reverse order, then. The Ninth Circuit said that it wasn't sure that the penalties even applied, civil or criminal, even applied to governments, and they don't. The only place it...
Am I right? The EPA's position is they're not taking a position, and the statute doesn't require them to take a position on everything that they could take a position on.
And that blends into again, in reverse order, the second.
Am I right? Well, am I right about that part, right?
Yes and no. I mean, okay, this is a situation where the Congress directed EPA to issue statutes, the Clean Air Act...
Issue statutes.
I'm sorry, issue regulations. Yeah, heavens. And the Clean Air Act's timing sequence are EPA issues general regulations, states meet them, and then the time in which states have to issue these implementation plans or standards evaporates.
Is there something that would prevent them from waiting until it's part of a SIP and then approving it at that point?
That's many years down road.
I understand that, but is there what you won't be heard until that actually happens, so what, that is, if they don't issue any rule one way
but
or the other.
They may not even submit it for SIP credit. They may just issue a rule, and this happens.
Well, then you can challenge it when they issue the rule.
Right, and we would rather, this is a Schultz versus automatic laundry case, we would rather not have this EPA, or we would rather have EPA on our side.
Schultz versus automatic laundry, did the court say EPA must issue an interpretation of something?
Well, there was an EPA interpretation that was contrary.
But here they have no interpretation.
Correct.
Okay, let me ask one more question. Was I right that you're not asking us to vacate any California rules today?
We're using the California rules to show that we have standing against
them. Yes, I understand.
If we win this case against EPA, we will have a very easy time with them, but we are not currently challenging, asking for injunctive relief. Very quickly, the Navajo tribe case is in a reply at footnote four, where this court said it wasn't going to be too strict or was about the application of the 60-day rule. And again, Congress in both the Senate and House reports in 77 approved that. The specific language.
Can you answer the questions or address the questions that Judge Garland was raising about the reopener?
Very quickly, if I could start with Judge Williams's question, which is, what's the specific language? Here in 307B2, it says you, and the you is usually an industry, and here it's a source of emissions. Here we're talking about rules rather than the direct emitter. And what it says is you cannot challenge a rule that you could have challenged under 307B1 in an action for enforcement. Well, this is an enforcement proceeding.
A federal action.
Correct. And so,
wouldn't the enforcement action be a state action?
State or federal, it doesn't matter. The point is, once EPA
state action wouldn't be state, and it's going to be a state rule, right? Ultimately,
well, it could be a federal or a state rule. I mean, they can get state rules and get federalized. The point is, the limitation on review that Judge Williams was looking at. If I missed something, I apologize. But the point is that the very express limitation on review is if you're a source that is emitting in violation of an EPA rule and you're trying to challenge that rule collaterally, that's impermissible. So it's better for us than Judge Williams said. Judge Williams said, here are some specific criteria in 307B1 that allow review. In addition, in B2, there's specific criteria that prohibit review, and we're not covered by that. So we are in the wide open.
How about the other question?
Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize.
You're going to have to be taking some of that time that the intervener gave up. But go ahead. Why do you think this was reopened?
Well, first of all, EPA said so. In our reply at 7, we brought an action to compel them to answer our petition, and they said, we have now
That puts an agency in a bind, right? Because unless they just throw it out.
Well, no, they won based on the fact. They mooted our All Writs Act decision based on the fact that they had their assertion that they had issued a notice of proposed rulemaking to address the issues that ARPA raised. If we were EMA in this case or
suppose they hadn't said
XYZ,
that in that document.
What's that?
Is that all you're resting on?
No, that's one thing. They're estopped against this one petitioner. Maybe not against all comers, but against this one petitioner. In addition, there is a rulemaking here. If they had just denied our petition and gone their happy way and there hadn't been this other rulemaking, the extent to which we're blended up with it is unclear. If there is a rulemaking, they adopted all these rules. Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers basically says if there's a new agency order affirming that decision, Montana versus Clarks is the same thing. There's a new rule here, a new regulation, a new notice of final rulemaking. We're within the 60 days of that. And so that's.
What's precisely are you referring to when you say the new rule? The repromulgation of the same, or are you talking about the other rule?
The repromulgation of the same. There's two final agency actions. One is the denial of our petition, which is problematic for some of the reasons you're saying, but we think, we can seek review. But even if that, moving that aside, there's a new notice of final rulemaking. They put the rule forward. We commented. They hid the answers over here rather than in the preamble. But that doesn't matter. They often issued response to comments in separate documents.
You like the fact that they responded, I assume. This is a matter of sound government. It's a good thing.
Yeah, well, that's
an agency responds.
Absolutely.
If an agency knows it's then reopening a 60-day clock, that's going to be a disincentive to them explaining their decisions.
You're saying you can get them anyway because then you can sue for failure to give a reasoned response.
Exactly. See, that was the
right. And the third,
got to be a narrow
the third thing in our yeah. in our quiver on this issue is that we didn't have standing in 1994. Or 96, and we do now. We're spending 8 cents a gallon in Texas. We're currently subject to regulations. There's the threat of regulations causes us to recalibrate our fleets. Just that interest alone. I mean, that's millions and billions of dollars. We think we do have standing now. The notion that EMA controls on the in-use issue. First of all, EMA didn't argue the 246 issue. That really wasn't even available because it's not until American Honda versus Guyer, where you say there is conflict preemption, even in an express preemption statute with a savings clause. That's an important link. That opens up 246. 246 is one reason for throwing out the EMA versus EPA holding. We're certainly not collaterally stopped by EMA versus EPA. And then also this notion that Section 213D.
You don't think we're collaterally stopped?
What's that?
Aren't we collaterally stopped?
No.
No, really?
There's a difference between stare decisis and collateral estoppel.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding. I'm using the word in a...
Okay, no, I understand, of course. but, you know, the one is it's binding even if it's wrong. I mean, if we were EMA, we would be stuck.
No, that's not our rule. Our rule is doesn't matter who the party is. We're still stuck.
But the law has changed significantly.
Well, that's
is that Guyer?
Yes, and also I think Buckman had the same language in it. All of a sudden, I mean, and that goes to MEMA, and it's cited in our brief. Yeah. MEMA versus EPA says there is no conflict preemption. Now all of a sudden, there is. I would say that there is. Certainly, there's the opportunity for you to consider it anew. Also, the 213D, the notion that that incorporates 209D into 209E is nonsensical because 213D only applies to new vehicles. If that somehow incorporated the standard, the in-use provisions of 209D for motor vehicles into 209E, you'd only have the ability to do it because 213D only applies to new vehicle standards. It would only be you'd be able to regulate the in-use application of a piece of equipment on the showroom floor, which is preposterous. And
do we have any more questions from the bench? No, I think even with the full generosity of California, there's no more time.
Okay.
Case will be taken under submission. Thank you very much.